1 million people in the U.S. have died from COVID-19. That's according to numbers out last week from the Johns Hopkins Coronavirus Resource Center. It's a number that can be hard to wrap our heads around. And after hearing stories about the growing death toll for more than 2 years now, it's easy to become numb to the level of pain and grief caused by the pandemic. Our next guest studies mass trauma and how communities and countries collectively remember it. He's with us today to talk about making sense of great loss. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel overwhelmed? Is it hard for you to comprehend fully how many people have died in this pandemic? If so, you are definitely not alone. Have you or someone you know lost a loved one? What has grieving during the pandemic been like for you? If you lost someone, whether it was because of COVID-19 or another cause? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Eric Boynton is a philosopher and edited the book Trauma and Transcendence, Suffering and the Limits of Theory. He's provost and dean of Beloit College. Eric, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. I'm glad to be here.
It can be, of course, tough to cope with the loss of one loved one. A million deaths, a huge number. How do we start to wrap our minds around that?
Right. I mean, this is an age-old problem that the difficulty of coming to terms with a single death. I mean, a single death can be incalculable in certain ways, but death on a mass scale that affects an entire population, and in this case, as it has in the past, affects the whole world, is a scale that is difficult to find the modes by which to calculate or capture the kind of loss. And so the feeling, the recognition of this loss is one of just overwhelm, of inability, recognizing that the powers or abilities we have to take stock of what has just happened always come up short. And it's that recognition of inability that has to be paid attention to, I think, in the very first instance of trying to grasp what essentially comes across as ungraspable. That might be a start at the answering that kind of question.
Are there things we can do as communities, as society, I don't know, at the government level to memorialize, to do things ritually or symbolically to help us cope and understand this?
Right. So there's been some interesting movements around in memory studies, collective memory studies and memorialization, really since the first half of the last century, after the atrocities of the First and Second World Wars. Memorialization is often about a country or a nation reckoning with its past and setting its course for its future. And so a lot of memorialization over the past centuries has been about large stony obelisks, large monuments that talk about overcoming odds or talk about victories or talk about ways of gathering together a nation and pointing towards a different kind of future. And this is always about moments of inauguration. So a nation rallies around some kind of event that then opens up what it means to be a citizen to that nation. In this case, we're finding over the last 80 years or so, there's been a shift in memorialization around recognizing the inability to talk about victories, to memorialize in stony kind of positive ways what has just happened. So one quick example of this, of course, is the 9/11 memorial in New York City with the reflecting pools that essentially are reflections of absence. So the loss of buildings, the absence of buildings, the footprint where the buildings once stood now become a waterfall that flows down into this dark abyss. And so it's actually using absence as a way of memorializing what happened on 9/11. And that technique has been around now for a number of decades, and it's being used more and more as a way of, again, thinking about what has happened in 9/11 or thinking about what happened in the atrocities in World War II as a way of setting a course for a nation going forward, not by something positive, but by a counter monument, by a monument that also reflects where civilization went awry where we find such a deep and a profound loss that there's nothing that can fill in that gap. And so the only thing left to do is to memorialize it as loss, as gap, as inability to truly fathom. So the 9/11 memorials are one of those things, but also memorials for the murdered Jews of Europe in the heart of Berlin is another example of that. And the recent memorial in Birmingham, Alabama, to the numerous lynching victims in the South is another reflection of this kind of memorialization that still attempts to chart a path forward for a nation, but not by men on horses, but through other means. Rob, does that kind of make sense?
Yeah. We're talking to philosopher Eric Boynton from Beloit College, provost and dean there, looking at how we cope or comprehend the scale of loss from something like COVID-19. As the U.S. just passed a million deaths last week, you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, maybe your experiences. That's 800-642-1234. Eric, I wonder if there's something about the way this all proceeded, the deaths, as opposed to a horrific but very public event like a 9/11 or a hurricane or natural disaster. So much of the suffering and death happened in emergency rooms, in homes, where we weren't confronted with it, didn't witness it in the moment or day to day. Does that affect how we process it, how we understand the scale of it?
Yeah, Rob, I think that's a great question. I do think there's a difference. Hitting a million deaths over 2 years due to pandemic, I think, is very different than commemorating loss due to horrific tragedy, warfare, those kinds of events. Even 9/11, which, you know, the planes hit and within a few hours the building fell. So that really is an event that you can place a day upon. But the pandemic is a slow burn. And there's something about living through this moment for so many months and spreading this million deaths over so many months that has, I think, it's a different way of taking stock. There's a way in which the dramatic kind of loss is now felt as a malaise, as an underlying anxiety about the future versus a momentary flash that makes you think or question the future. Now there's this ongoing task to negotiate the world in the midst of pandemic, in the midst of loss, in the midst of continuing loss, that is very different than a one-time kind of event that maybe we could memorialize in other ways. So I do think sometimes after atrocities, you know, the future is dark. The future is not open for me to step into. In this situation, I'm constantly moving into the future in the midst of a pandemic. But I think there's a way in which we're moving into the future, negotiating ongoing anxiety, ongoing threat, ongoing malice, the world kind of pressing in on us in ways that is different this time. I don't know, Rob, does that make sense to you?
Sure. And now you've also talked elsewhere about the role of misinformation and why someone might seek it out or be at least approachable for it. Can you tell us how that comes into play with your thoughts on the pandemic?
Right. So I think if you look back in history, the ways in which we as humans writ large, dealing with these kinds of mass events of suffering and atrocity and loss, there is always attempts to try to grasp this thing, to try to put it into contained, give it some kind of parameter so that I can talk about what just happened. And there's ways in which thinking about drilling down on, put it this way, calculating the loss is one attempt to begin to take stock of what has just happened due to the pandemic. So, running numbers, a million versus 500,000, we could still have this our conversation if it was a million or a million five. The numbers aren't really important in this sense of the loss overwhelming us. But we also have this desire to take stock, to control, to think about how it is we might have done things differently, how we might do things differently in the future, how I can organize my life presently right now to gain control of this thing. And my idea, and I don't know if I can defend this all the way down, but my idea is that the belief in misinformation is one way of gaining control of that which feels overwhelming. So it's the attempt to not even pay attention to the pandemic as pandemic. It's a way of taking stock, of calculating the pandemic by not paying attention to it. And so I think it's far from belief in misinformation, is far from turning your back on the pandemic. I think it's actually facing the pandemic, and it's a way or a technique or a mechanism by which to deal with what it is that we're all facing.
We're talking to Eric.
In that regard, go ahead, Rob.
We're talking to Eric Boynton, philosopher and provost and dean of Beloit College, with us today to help us think about what it means for the U.S. to lose a million people to COVID-19. We crossed that milestone last week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has it been hard for you to wrap your mind around how many people have been lost in this pandemic? How do you think we should commemorate locally, nationally, within families, people lost over this time? How do you think we'll remember this in future generations? And a few moments ago, I said, we didn't see this happen. You know, we didn't see all the suffering and loss, except some of us did. If you worked in hospitals and emergency rooms and saw the harm done by this day after day, I would appreciate it if you'd be willing to share how you tried to cope with that, how you wrapped your mind around it. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're talking about the million lives lost in the U.S. because of COVID-19. We crossed that milestone officially anyway last week. And how to understand the level of loss, the pain and suffering that comes with that. Eric Boynton of Beloit College, philosopher there, stays with us. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your own experience with loss during the pandemic. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller now. Brian is with us in Appleton. Brian, hi.
Hi. I'm a healthcare worker, and I know there was a better possible outcome for this thing. Day after day, I can't tell you how many patients that I would see in primary care that were going to listen to their Fox News more than they would listen to their physician. And inevitably, it would come true. And then even after the fact, they would still not believe it. And I think it's appalling that the politicians in the area here were willing to risk their constituents' health in order to rally the troops as opposed to do the right thing. That's all I had to say.
Well, Brian, can I ask before you go? I know some healthcare workers were driven out of the field because of some of what you just mentioned. Are you still in there doing the job?
Well, I'm sundowning because of retirement, but otherwise, yes.
Okay. Brian, thank you so much for sharing that story. Eric, Brian brings up something else maybe unique about the pandemic and how we deal with it. The divisiveness, the politics that came up around it, and a lot of the misinformation that attached to that. How does that affect things?
Yeah, I do think there's a way in which the pandemic, of course, every kind of mass event like this, suffering on a mass scale, has ripple effects. It ripples through families, it ripples through communities. But I think this is exactly right, that this pandemic also has effects or ripple effects that exacerbate the issues that the pandemic has inflicted on us as a community and brought to the fore what was already there in terms of divisiveness, which I think, frankly, adds to the feeling that I talked about before, this basic malaise that kind of hangs over the pandemic, is that as a nation, we can't rally around a single interpretation or understanding of what it is that's happened. And that's actually something that memorialization or commemoration attempts to do, is to draw together a variety of different approaches into more or less a single trajectory. And it might be difficult in the near term to really come to terms with what happens because of the divisiveness itself. And so if there's a way in which the people on the front lines giving aid to those who are suffering are not only impinged by the disease and what they see all around them, but also the ways in which their work is not being valued, I think that's a ripple effect from what it is that we're experiencing on this kind of mass scale.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Eric, I've seen people throughout the course of this talk about the concept of psychic numbing, and it comes up again with, you know, the latest horrific mass shooting as well. This idea that we see it so much and we desensitize to it, but maybe there's an upside there too, because you can't live constantly meditating on the horror of loss from COVID and the pandemic. How do we find a middle ground, if that's such a thing?
Right. No, this is difficult. And this is, we can look at the events in Texas, at the pandemic. I mean, the world is replete. I mean, we can look in different regions around the world currently, Ukraine, for instance, or, current health disparities in the United States, for instance. All those things will lead to, what I've heard as a kind of fatigue, right? A numbness, sometimes referred as compassion fatigue. There is a need, I think, to turn off, in order that those kinds of events aren't crushing for everyone. But that can only go so far, because the reason why you're desensitizing, or the reason why you're turning your back on those things, is because they're so pressing. It's because they ought not be. It's because we have to apply ourselves to those constant pressures that are tearing us down and tearing down our world. And so there's no ability not to pay attention. And because of that, we find ourselves worn out, fatigued. So I think it's a kind of a balancing act. There's going to be a shift, but the fact is that we find ourselves fatigued is pointing to the phenomenon that we cannot properly live in a world that has these kinds of events in it, that we have to do something, whether it's taking charge and working on overcoming the conditions that allow those events to take place, or desensitizing. Either one of those things is in itself a kind of reaction. One of the ways in which we can find ourselves better able to attend to the suffering all around us is not always to think about empathy, the ways in which I have to imagine someone else's suffering in order to understand what's going on. But there's a way in which allowing our own suffering to do its work, and that actually opens us up to the suffering of others. And so there's a way in which a community of community who comes together around what it is that's happening to us collectively is maybe a one approach to get at this problem of fatigue.
One thing I'd wanted to ask about before we run out of time, Eric, is I've talked to people who've done projects, including an online project called Who We Lost, giving a little personal window into people who have been lost. And we see in the coverage of children lost this week in Texas, telling us some, not just them, about one of the number of people killed, but something about them individually. How important is to have that, I guess, that personal image of people we've lost, as opposed to the statistic of people we lost?
No, I think that's vitally important, that you have to do all of those things. So one example of that is if you take the Vietnam War Memorial, which when you stand back is this dark cut into the earth. But when you come close, it's the stones upon which individual names are cast. And then, interesting enough, your reflection is in the stone itself. And so the Vietnam War Memorial, I think, has that doubleness to it, is both the individual names and also the weight or the size of the loss. In a number of memorials in Germany and Poland, there is the Book of Life, which is the documentation of all the Jewish people who were lost to the Holocaust. And each individual name is listed there. But in addition, and this is also in Israel, but in addition, you see the mass of pages hanging before you. It's the largest book you've ever seen. So that kind of combination of both individual human loss on a very private scale and the ways in which that loss has deep and profound effects for the people around that person, and at the same time, seeing the multiplication of each one of those deaths on this mass scale. I think that in combination is what needs to be accomplished.
Briefly, Eric, we just have a minute left. Do you see efforts? Are we doing enough to try to memorialize the individuals and the mass of people lost during the pandemic?
Oh, I think we're in the thick of it. I don't think I've seen a good one. The New York Times has attempted to do this a couple times. I think that proper memorialization comes with some time, the ability to look backwards a bit and think about what it is that, as best we can, the ways in which we can begin to point or gesture to what it is that's occurred to us as a collective people. So I think it's probably too soon, Rob, to take a stab at that. I do think there's probably people who are thinking about what a memorial will look like. The thing is that the memorial in this nation might be different than a memorial in another nation, and there might be some desire for a global reckoning as well, but I don't know what that would be yet.
Eric, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. I appreciate it.
That's Eric Boynton, philosopher who studied trauma and how societies remember it. He's provost and dean of Beloit College. He was with us today to talk about lives lost to COVID-19. As of last week, the U.S. death toll crossed 1 million, and how we comprehend loss on that scale.